presentation of CITR News.
CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
And now here's your host, Carrie Baptist.
Good evening. We have a packed show for you this evening. In the news this week, we'll be bringing you coverage of a recent protest against provincial funding cuts to Vancouver HIV/AIDS organizations, an interview with Arno Schortinghaus, the president of the Vancouver Area Cycling Coalition, talking about the now permanent Burrard Bridge bike lane, and the possibilities of non-motorized transportation during the Olympic Games. We'll also be bringing you a live interview with Tristan Markle of Vancouver Action, discussing the recently passed Assistance to Shelter Act by the BC government and recent protests against that act. We'll also be bringing you coverage of the recent Gateway Project protest that shut down work on the bridge for 4 hours. And finally, in international news, coverage of the Copenhagen Climate Change Summit from the perspective of the Canadian Youth Delegation. We'll have all this, plus your weekend weather forecast coming up this hour right here on News 101. It's been a difficult season for organizations and agencies in this province, all of them depending on government funding and the recent budget cuts. First, it was arts organizations, and now HIV/AIDS programs are the latest to see their funding cut by the province. News 101's Brad Pepping attended the recent protest at the Vancouver Art Gallery against the cuts and spoke with provincial MLA for the West End, Spencer Herbert, and David Swan, the executive director of AIDS Vancouver.
So today I have on the line Spencer Herbert, MLA for Vancouver West End, who's participated today in a rally at the Vancouver Art Gallery hosted by AIDS Vancouver, as well as BC Persons with AIDS Society. And so I was just hoping, Spencer Herbert, if you could just walk us through your participation today and maybe describe to us what happened.
Sure. Today was a day of a whole bunch of groups, community-based health organizations, which work in the AIDS field, gathered to speak out against the BC Liberals' cuts to AIDS prevention programs. We've seen cuts, for AIDS Vancouver, as an example, of about $250,000 cut from their budget. That'll affect their ability to do all the programs they do, as well as, I believe, these kinds of cuts will just cost the healthcare system more in the long run. And I say that because if you're able to prevent just one infection of HIV, you're saving the healthcare system $250,000. And so all of these agencies, whether it be AIDS Vancouver, Youth Co-AIDS Society, Native Health, BCPWA, Dr. Peter Center, all these groups do really crucial work in AIDS prevention as well as AIDS care. And they're getting chopped, and they, in fact, heard they got their budgets cut on World AIDS Day, December 1st.
Well, so, that's quite ironic.
It is quite ironic, and it just really shows the lack of thought put into these cuts. The other thing that's really scary is they've been told that there's a phase three in this cut process where government may be considering eliminating support for their programs altogether. And that we don't know when that discussion will happen, probably in the summer, but we were there to speak out today because these groups do such crucial work in a way that government doesn't do or can't do. You know, they have huge volunteer bases. They're able to raise funds privately as well to support their efforts. And because of all the work they do, they're actually increasing, in a sense, the healthcare budget through that kind of work, whereas these cuts are going to cut their ability to do prevention services, but also cut their ability to raise those extra funds that are dedicated to health care. So it's very short-sighted.
And so I guess kind of what you've touched on is the difference between prevention and treatment.
That's right.
And so do you think that there is quite a large role for the province to play in that type of prevention? Do you think that the responsibility should still lie with them funding it, or should it come through these types of organizations?
Well, I think the healthcare system, you know, it's the province where the buck stops. It's the government who, in the end, sets up what you're supposed to, how we're supposed to address healthcare. And prevention should be one of our key goals as a province, because if you can stop the problem today, it's going to save you way more money down the road than if you just let the problem get worse. And we've seen that in all walks of life. You know, there are cuts to addiction services, there are cuts to senior services, there are cuts to frontline health services, all have an impact on what happens later. You know, you could even take that further to look at the level of poverty amongst children. We know the social determinants of health show that if you keep people in poverty, the chances are of their health being worse than if you actually address those issues early on and help them get out of that situation. You're going to be saving yourselves money. You know, you could even take that to homelessness and the number of homeless people on the street. It costs the government more to keep people on the street than it does to get them housed, just because of the legal costs, the police costs, the health care costs, etc. So we need to be thinking proactively if we're going to deal with the health care crisis we've got in this province, and that's what we were speaking out about today at the rally at the Art Gallery with all the community-based health organizations.
Okay, and thank you very much for speaking today. I actually just have one last thing that I was hoping that I could throw your way. I'm not sure if you caught this, but recently it came out that VANOC is going to be providing around 100,000 free condoms for
the
athletes as well as the executives who are going to be in the athletes' village. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if maybe you could comment on that.
Well, what I've heard before is that at athletes' villages, they are definitely a center of potential infection. You've got a whole bunch of people very excited, new country, new place, coming together, and we've got to be doing as much as we can to ensure people are using best practices and being safe. Because there's a huge range of people from all different cultural backgrounds in different places. So I know VANOC or the Olympics has done that before. It's actually a very small campaign this time in Beijing. They had quite a large campaign to both educate the population as well as the athletes. VANOC really dropped the ball on that, and so did the provincial government. They had committed to making a bigger deal, but they didn't this time. And that's unfortunate, because it was a great way of reaching out to people who might not be connected through traditional means to healthcare information and prevention information, and by working with athletes, you can reach a whole another group of people to encourage them to use condoms and that kind of thing.
Right. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today, and thank you for taking part in this demonstration.
Much appreciated. Have a good day.
Thanks. You too.
Bye.
Bye now.
Thanks to Brad and Spencer Herbert. It's now time for some public service announcements, but stay tuned. We've got coverage of the now permanent Burrard Bike Lane and a discussion of non-motorized transportation in Vancouver during the Olympic Games. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Want to know what's going on around town? LiveMusicVancouver.com is the Lower Mainland's comprehensive source for live music listings. We've got more than 350 shows listed at any time, and our listings are updated continuously by hundreds of the very people who put on the shows you love. Artist information and MP3s are accessible right from the listings, as are maps and calendars for virtually every venue in the city. All this and tons more totally free at livemusicvancouver.com.
Remember when you first learned about the birds and the bees? Want to learn more about the birds and the bees and the berries, urban agriculture, delicious homegrown food, solar energy, and much more? Check out the Society Promoting Environmental Conservation. Come to one of our workshops, join our solar panel tour, or go to our website, www.spec.bc.ca, for more information.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. The City of Vancouver has recently made the Burrard Bridge Bike Lane trial a permanent addition to Vancouver's cycling infrastructure. Andrew Longhurst spoke with Vancouver Area Cycling Coalition President Arno Shortinghouse this afternoon about the announcement.
Comment on the number of bikes that we saw during the trial period.
Well, it went up from around an average of 3,000 a day to 4,000, so it was quite a significant increase from before the trial to after the trial.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still, I think it's still pretty busy even now. It's people, everybody I've spoke to, like cyclists, they love it. And pedestrians are pretty positive about it too, because they don't have to worry about the cyclists scooting by very closely.
Are the numbers what you expected them to be?
They're actually, well, I'd say they're a bit higher than I expected, but I'm pleasantly surprised that there's that many people going over now.
And what have been, just give me a sense of some of the comments you've gotten as president of the VACC. You probably have had numerous comments, and you mentioned that pedestrians are grateful not to have cyclists
exactly
on the road with them. What are some of the other comments?
We collected a bunch of comments. We had commuter stations, we had a tent there and, celebrating the opening of the bridge, and we had that several times throughout the year. And so people stopped by and we collected their views, and people are very positive about it. There's people there that, for instance, refused to cycle over it before because they considered it too dangerous, and they're cycling over now.
Have you received comments from motorists? Both positive comments and some negative comments?
They have difficulty stopping, obviously, but we had one person honk their horn. He had to slow down to do this. He saw us there, Vancouver Area Cycling Coalition and the tent, and he sort of shook our fist at us and honked his horn, but he had to slow down because he was going so fast. So he was obviously not slowed down by the extra lane being used for cycling now. So that's the only, kind of expression that we had of motorists going by. I've heard that most motorists are, and I think this is true, that most motorists are actually quite happy that this has happened.
Mm-hmm. So this is timely, since right now Copenhagen, the summit in Copenhagen is wrapping up. What is the Burrard bike lane, how does that represent what our city's should look like and how they should be designed? Is this indicative of what we will be seeing in the future?
Oh, I'm pretty sure. It's a very small step, and there's been so much anguish put into this very small step. But it turned out to be quite successful, so I think we can see more steps like this in the future. We're actually hopeful in the VACC that the other lane on the other side will also be used for cycling, and then the east sidewalk can be given back to the pedestrians. That would be the best solution for a permanent solution. But we're hopeful that will happen.
Has the city been responsive to that? To opening up the other side?
Well, it's going to require a lot of. I've heard that there are some councillors that are in favor of that, but I don't think it's unanimous. I think it's if a lot of people wrote in and phoned in and said that's what they want, then it might happen. If a lot of people phone in and say, oh, don't close down that lane, don't close down that other lane,
right,
then it probably won't happen. So it's we're very hopeful, and we're going to keep pushing for the having that the northbound lane closed or open for the exclusive use of cycling as well.
So going back to the early days of the trial, originally there was considerable, in the first few days, considerable anger from some motorists, although it wasn't as widespread as many anticipated, and it seems like it sort of really dissipated quite quickly, and people just realized this is part of the bridge now.
Yeah.
Were you glad to see that?
Well, I almost anticipated that. It's been shown in around the world that if you remove traffic lanes or even close down roadways, that what happens is traffic disappears.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what happened here. It's for the first few days there was a bit less traffic because the city put out a big media campaign and a communication campaign, and they tried to get drivers to use the Granville Street Bridge instead for going south, and so the traffic dropped a bit, and there was really no slowdown for traffic ever on Burrard, either in either direction. In fact, it may have actually been a bit, I think it was actually a bit faster heading northbound after the trial, and southbound was a tiny bit slower, but it really didn't affect traffic that much, except for people on Pacific. It slowed them down a bit.
Right.
But on Burrard, there was really no change.
Well, there are a number of complaints from local businesses that because of the change in the traffic pattern, that they were at a disadvantage because customers wouldn't be able to as easily park in front of their establishment. Has that dissipated as well, those concerns?
No. It's just one block or two blocks on Hornby, just south of Pacific. The reason for it is because, for safety reasons, the city no longer allowed right turns from Pacific onto Hornby. And some of the merchants there thought that caused their business to drop. But it became clear, I heard one of the people actually talk to City Council on this very issue, and it's become clear to me that it's not so much the lack of car traffic in front of the store, but the lack of pedestrian traffic. Mm. And the reason for that is because the east sidewalk is closed. So you don't get as many pedestrians going on the east sidewalk, so they don't go down Hornby toward the seawall either. So I think that probably had a lot to do with it. So giving the east sidewalk back to pedestrians, I think, will do a lot to help the shops along that particular piece of roadway.
One of the big noticeable changes is the large bike box on Hornby.
Yeah.
For northbound cyclists.
Yeah.
Are we going to be seeing more bike boxes?
There already are quite a few bike boxes throughout the city, and this is just one more in the growing number. Yeah, I'm pretty sure we'll see a lot of these as we go forward.
Recently, I was down in Portland, and I was amazed just at the number of bike boxes present throughout the city.
Yeah.
Not just within the downtown, but in neighborhoods and just all around the city.
Route between that links Vancouver through Burnaby to New Westminster is a 25-kilometer, and a lot of it's off road,
mm-hmm.
And so it's a very nice and flat as well, quite flat for most of it, and so that's a really nice bike route. And then the Canada Line Bridge over the Fraser at the bottom of Cambie Street, that has a pedestrian and bike deck on it. And it's a really, really nice addition to the cycling network as well.
So, with the Olympics upcoming, are efforts being made by VanOck, by the province, or by the city to increase the percentage of downtown traffic that is non-motorized?
Oh yeah, they're looking at all ways of reducing the amount of car traffic.
Has the VACC been involved in any of those efforts?
We have. We're actually working with some schools in Vancouver to encourage biking and walking to school so that there's less of that traffic on the roadways.
Okay.
And we're not directly involved with this, but I believe that the city is putting out valet bike parking at different locations, Olympic venues.
Great.
And we've been encouraging people throughout the fall. We had the Fall Bike to Work Week, and even today we had a commuter station to celebrate, to encourage people to keep cycling throughout the winter.
Great.
We've been doing that. We've been doing a lot of things to try to encourage people to keep cycling through the winter and through the Olympics.
So what would you leave our listeners with? Any suggestions about ways to keep warm and stay dry and be safe during the winter months for cyclists?
Yeah, well, it's wear good rain gear, have lots of lights, be bright, because it's going to be dark probably when you're riding, and be careful. It's quite doable to ride during the winter. I actually prefer it because it's a little cooler. I find it a little too hot during the summer. So it's actually quite pleasant to ride throughout the winter.
Well, great. Thank you, Arno. It's always a pleasure to talking with you.
Indeed. Thanks for inviting me.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks to Andrew for bringing us that coverage. We're now going to take a quick break, but stay tuned. Up next, we bring you a live interview with Tristan Markle of Vancouver Action about the recently passed Assistance to Shelter Act, right after these public service announcements.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, Hotbox, The Kiss Store, Slickety Jim's Chat and Chew, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, The Whip Gallery Restaurant, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member. Get a free friends card and feel the love.
The AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the Helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the Helpline is one of many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The Helpline number is 604-696-4666 or contact us online at www.aidsvancouver.org.
MentalBeast.com is set to release its new comedy series,
telling the riotously funny Christmas tale of a radio station on the verge of collapse.
Starting December 7th, visit MentalBeast.com to follow the podcasts and video episodes.
Each podcast will feature a brand new Christmas-themed song by one of Vancouver's hottest indie acts, while the webisodes follow the behind-the-scenes antics at this down-on-its-luck station.
The series culminates with a party at the Biltmore Friday, December 18th, and the release of the Eggnog Experience compilation CD.
Featuring holiday performances from compilation contributors Brastronaut, Machu Picchu, Fine Mist, Makeup Videotape, World Club, Needles and Pins, Analog Bell Service, Rose Melberg and Nick Hergovich, Basketball, Tight, Solid, Vancouver, and Apollo Ghosts.
And a live special screening of the final video episode of Mental Beast.
As well as CITR's own Radio Zero DJs, Tyler Fedchuk and Cam Dales. So join CITR and Mental Beast at the Biltmore on December 18th.
All the proceeds from the Mental Beast Project and Eggnog Experience compilation album will be donated to the Vancouver Food Bank.
This is News 101, and the current time is 5:26. In local news, UBC Professor Carmen Mills and other protesters took to the Gateway Bridge December 7th and December 17th, shutting down traffic for several hours to protest the impact of the current Gateway project. Andrew Longhurst this afternoon spoke with Professor Mills.
So can you tell me a little bit about, firstly, the December 7th protest?
Okay. On December 7th, a bunch of people, it was organized by GatewaySucks.org, but that's a big loose group, and a bunch of us gathered under an overpass at Highway 1 and First Avenue, which is being widened as part of the Gateway Project. And we had Patrick Condon with us there, the SFU professor, and it was quite a great bunch, about 50 people, 7 degrees below. And we shut down, effectively occupied the construction site and shut down the construction for about, until about midnight.
And what was the response from, did police eventually show up?
They did. The police, the construction crew came. The police came. The police sat very quietly and waited until the CBC camera crew had left before they actually were surprisingly. They were pretty impolite. They shoved some people around and made us get down off the equipment. And then they went away for. Then they left for a while. And, we decided to call it at around midnight, but we have other tricks up our sleeves.
Mm-hmm. Were any charges placed?
No, they weren't.
Okay. And tell me a little bit about the group that organized the action, the protest.
Well, Gateway Sucks is a grassroots group. It doesn't have a really official status of any sort, but it includes, we have about 1,000 people that are on our bulletin list, and it's been around for about 4 years. There are a lot of academics, activists, scientists, all kinds of people, politicians that support Gateway Sucks. But what we are, there are so many groups working to oppose Gateway in so many ways, but we have pretty much evolved into the direct action wing of the Gateway Resistance Movement.
Okay. And tell me a little bit about the aim of the group and the loose group. As you mentioned, it's a collection of people from different communities within Vancouver. What is the goal of the group and of these types of actions and protests?
Well, the goal ultimately is to shut down the Gateway Project, which is if climate change has a face in British Columbia, it's the Gateway Project, which is kind of couched as a transportation project, but really it's what it's all about is increasing trade with China and creating a corridor to move tar sands oil out of Canada and over the ocean. So our aim is to draw attention to this and to increase public opposition to it and ultimately to shut it down, because it's entirely possible at this point that that could happen.
Do you believe the BC government has gotten off too easily with this and letting it sort of be usurped by the climate, the tax on carbon in the province?
Oh, absolutely. The Gateway Project makes a mockery of the carbon tax and about the green initiatives by the BC government. It's even their own studies say that the Gateway Freeway Project, just that part of it, is going to increase GHG emissions by over 160,000 tons a year, and that's 7 times what they claimed they'd reduce it. The claimed reduction for the Canada line. It completely makes a mockery of any pretense of the government towards wanting to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions.
And what are the main components of the Gateway Project? Can you explain about some of those road-building projects?
Sure. It's actually more enormous than anyone has quite perceived. You can see a map on gatewaysucks.org, but in the Lower Mainland, it has 3 major components, which are the expansion of the Portman Bridge and the South Fraser Perimeter Road, which is a huge brand new highway, which is in the works now, that runs along the Fraser, and the biggest part of all, which is really the ultimate goal of it all, which is the tripling of Deltaport. So it's a monster. It's a $10 billion monster.
Are there any components of the Gateway Project that are trying to increase non-motorized transportation throughout the city and the region?
Well, no, that's the crazy thing. I mean, one of the crazy things, there are so many other ways that they can move goods. If there was actually a demand to move goods from the port, which there isn't and it's falling, they could do it by rail, they could do it through shipping up the Fraser. There are all kinds of alternatives, but this is the as far as that goes, the only effect of the Gateway Project in the Lower Mainland would be to increase traffic through the region.
Now, I understand there was another protest last night, is that correct?
Yeah. There was a really great little action last night where a bunch of our folks from south of the Fraser, from Surrey and Delta, and this is a great example of how widespread opposition is, but a great group of warriors from Surrey and Delta went out and they did some billboard modifications, some sign modifications to the big announcement boards that are down on King George Highway. They're down under the near the Alex Fraser Bridge, and these big signs, if you go along there, along the route of the South Fraser Perimeter Road, say things like transit, not truck routes. They say homes, not highways, peatland, not pavement, and farms, not freeways. So these are people who are really concerned about their communities and about their farmland being destroyed. So they went out and the last day of the Copenhagen talks, they sent out a pretty clear message that the Gateway Project is not in anyone's interest.
So are there upcoming protests and actions?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt that there's direct action seems to be the way of the future, the way of the present for this, because clearly all the negotiations are actually, they're useful, but what really needs to be demonstrated right now is that the people are willing to take to the streets and are willing to put their bodies on the line to change the course of our world. So, yes, we are planning more actions. And if anyone goes to gatewaysucks.org, they can sign up, or they can email info@gatewaysucks.org, and we will let you know what's in the works, because it's actually really fun to do this kind of action, and it's very empowering to meet people, know you're not alone, and actually get some physical demonstration done.
Well, great. Thank you, Carmen, for speaking with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Andrew.
You're
most welcome.
This fall, the provincial legislature passed the Assistance to Shelter Act, a controversial new law which gives police the authority to force the homeless into shelters. The official story is that this is in order to protect the homeless from extreme weather. Tristan Markle of Vancouver Action is on the line now to discuss this legislation and the widespread perception that this new law is actually tied to the upcoming Olympics. Tristan, are you there?
Yes.
Hi. So could you tell us a little bit about the Assistance to Shelter Act?
Sure. The first we heard of this act was David Eby of the BC Civil Liberties Association filed some Freedom of Information requests and found that the provincial government had this legislation in the pipeline. And David Eby was wondering about what the government was going to do with homeless folks during the Olympics, and that's how he was able to get a hold of this information. And the early drafts of the legislation included if shelters were full, giving the police the power to put homeless folks in prison cells and so on. And that was in September and October. And a lot of people, I think, thought that the legislation was going to be just put away or tabled because it was so controversial. But just this past month, Minister Coleman, and this is under housing is under his portfolio, pushed the legislation through the House within 2 weeks, and it got first, second, third reading, royal assent, without much public discussion about it. And what the Act does is it gives police the power to forcibly use force to remove homeless folks from where they are against their will and bring them somewhere else. They don't have the power to bring them into a shelter and force them to stay in a shelter, because shelters aren't places that you can force people to stay, but they can drop them at the door of these places. And so the legislation gives police the power to do that.
So the official justification of the act is that it's to protect the homeless from extreme weather. Does that make sense to you? Do you agree with it?
Well, BC already has an extreme weather warning system, and that's been in place for years. And what that does is, if there is, quote, extreme weather, and there's local groups or boards that decide what that is, depending on the geography of the region, then they open up more shelters for people. So that's been in place for a while. And, of course, outreach workers would you know, notify people that there's these temporary shelter places that they can visit and give them blankets if they don't come and so on. So what this act does is it doesn't create an extreme weather framework that's already been there. All it does is create what Minister Coleman calls a new tool, which is give police the power to forcibly, against their will, remove homeless people from where they are. So that's the only thing that this legislation does. And if I get into my critique of it, first of all, it's unconstitutional. Undoubtedly, PIVOT will be launching a charter challenge against this. It doesn't work because it drives people away to hide, and it creates conditions of fear for people living on the street, fear of confrontation. There's already bad relations between police and many homeless folks. This will exacerbate that. Vancouver City Council, City of Victoria City Council passed motions saying they were very concerned about it. The police board has said that they will do their best to not create all the problems that come along with the legislation, but of course it's not up to them whether the law is on the books. Minister Coleman and Gordon Campbell passed it through the legislature.
Yes, because it is true that the VPD have said that they will enforce the act, but they will not force homeless people into shelters if they're overtly resisting, and that they will only use non-forceful touching, I believe is the quote, to urge homeless people to access shelter.
Right. So the main take-home message there is that the city councilors and the police board have said that they don't feel comfortable with this. Right, and that's because community organizations wrote them letters, gave delegations, put pressure on them to admit all these faults with the legislation. But again, it's not up to the city council or the police board whether this legislation is on the books. It's up to the provincial government, and they have passed it. So the legislation is there on the books. So a lot of people say, why continue to advocate to repeal this law, even though the police board and the city council have said they're uncomfortable with it? But that question contains the answer inside it. Why would you have a law that people know is wrong and know is unenforceable and shouldn't be enforced? So, it's clear that it should be repealed. However, again, to reiterate, it is not really up to the police board whether they will enforce it. It's up to them to decide a little bit of the details of how they define force and so on, but it's a provincial law, and it's not just in Vancouver, it's across the province. So even if one particular police board happens to have a chair, like right now we have Gregor Robinson, who will put pressure to not enforce it to its full extent, there's other jurisdictions across the province where people could be forcibly displaced to who knows where. This is a displacement power that could be used in all kinds of terrible ways.
So there was a protest this past Sunday against the act at the downtown police station on Main Street. Can you tell us who was there and what happened?
Yes, that was a great demonstration. It was organized by a coalition of downtown East Side groups and allies, including Carnegie Community Action Project, Downtown Eastside Women's Center, Power of Women Group, Streams of Justice, PIVOT Legal Society, Impact on Communities Coalition. And there's over 200 folks that showed up on a cold Sunday afternoon, and we heard a lot of residents and speakers of people who will be affected by this legislation, and they talked about the lack of shelter space, how illogical it is to have an unconstitutional law like this that gives police the power to force people to shelters when everyone knows that there's far more than twice as many homeless folks as shelter beds. So the hypocrisy of it was exposed, and people talked about their experiences on the street, their experiences with the police, and demanded that housing commitments, Olympic housing commitments, were delivered upon, that people address the root causes of homelessness, which includes, of course, building not just shelter space, but social housing, affordable housing, supportive housing, and so on.
So the Olympics was mentioned a lot at the protest. What do you see as the relationship between the Assistance to Shelter Act and the Olympics?
Well, two main points. One, the reason this was passed right now is because of the Olympics. So Minister Coleman pushed it through the House without much public debate or without much debate in the House. You rarely see controversial legislation like this ran through at that speed. So that tells you that there's an urgency. And secondly, he was able to do that because of the Olympics. So it's inconceivable that this would have happened in any other year. First of all, they wouldn't have done it, and second of all, it wouldn't have been successful in passing.
And so finally, just to tie back to what you were speaking about earlier, so the act has passed. What can we do now, people who have concerns about it?
Well, I know it sounds cliche, but it really is important to phone, email, and fax Gordon Campbell and Rich Coleman. All their information is on their websites. And I don't just mean once, but do it twice and consistently make their faxes and phones ring off the hook. But what we'll see as Olympics approach is that the act will be enforced in relevant jurisdictions, and it will affect individual people. It's important that their stories get out through the media, and I think that as the act is enforced and we hear terrible stories, then there's going to be demonstrations surrounding that, legal cases, and there's all kinds of ways to get involved, whether it's coming out to future marches or helping with any actions during the Olympics that are going to block this from happening. For example, there may be sanctuary set up so that people can be protected from the police, and people, so activists will need help with organizing and maintaining initiatives like that.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
So that was Tristan Markle of Vancouver Action. Now it's time for another break, but stay tuned. Up next is coverage of the UN Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen and your weekend weather forecast. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Stewie. Hey.
Hey there. So, it's been 24 hours. Got my money?
Oh, you know what? Just give me till next Friday. I'll have it for you.
Oh, that's funny. I could have sworn I said have it today.
Yeah, I don't have it. Sorry.
Oh, well, all right then. That's good, OJ.
Ah! Ah!
Yeah, that hurt.
Ah!
That hurt.
What the hell?
Yeah.
It feels so good.
Thank you to all the donors who pledged their financial support during the CITR on-air fund drive.
Oh,
we are moved by your generosity,
happens.
And thank you for enabling us to purchase new equipment and improve our programming. Do remember to stop by the station, pay your pledges, and pick up your prizes. We look forward to meeting you anytime between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. on weekdays. Thank you again for your amazing response. Listen to our happy voices on the air, happier after we purchase new equipment for our studios. Thanks again.
You got till 5 o'clock. You hear me? You got till 5 o'clock.
You freaking psychopath!
Clean yourself up.
Join Team PowerSmart. Set an energy conservation target of 10%. You'll get access to tools to help you conserve, and you can track your progress online. Visit bchydro.com/teampowersmart to join today. This message brought to you by BC Hydro PowerSmart and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
The Advocacy Office provides confidential and free representation, guidance, and assistance to students engaged in conflict with UBC. We advocate for students in preparing and attending formal meetings, hearings, and appeals against the university. Specifically, our office helps students with matters of student discipline, such as cheating, collaboration, or plagiarism, assigned standing, admissions, and financial assistance. We can also assist you in appeals to decisions made by UBC Library, parking, or housing. You are not alone. We're here to help. For more information, call 822-9855 or visit the website at www.ams.ubc.ca/advocacy.
Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Carrie Baptist, coming to you from live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us now. The current time is 5:48, and now it's time for a look at the UN Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen, which is currently winding up. Here we have the perspective of the Canadian Youth Delegation to the conference.
The Canadian Youth Delegation's daily news from the UN climate negotiations. In today's climate news for December 18th, talks seem deadlocked and perhaps set for a greenwash as what was supposed to be the last day of negotiations draws to a close. With leaders and heads of state from around the world here, there's a lot to lose if an agreement is not seen to be reached. However, there's even more to lose if we do not manage to come to a fair, ambitious, and binding agreement as soon as possible. The mood at the conference is a bit dark, as hopes dwindle somewhat, and the fear of a weak and purely political agreement grows. From the newly established NGO hub, far from the Bella Center, where negotiations are taking place, the Fossil of the Year award was handed out. Guess who won?
4, 3, 2, 1. And the Fossil of the Year goes to Canada! Canada, the big winner of the Fossil of the Year award. Canada has won Fossil Award after Fossil Award. We're joined now by Prime
Alex Minister Dukas from the CYD asked a few audience members what they thought of the Fossil of the Year award.
I've got Dave Martin from Greenpeace here, and I'm wondering what he thinks about Canada being awarded the Fossil of the Year award. So
let's go outside. Let's go
well, if there was any doubt, now we know for certain Canada is a climate bad boy, not a Boy Scout.
Climate change policy. We've got the breakdown here of the possible scenarios we may see coming out of this conference from Rhea Trivedi.
So they took 3 days on process to ultimately decide that they were going to continue negotiations in the Kyoto Protocol track. So there's been a huge debate. Developed countries don't want to see the Kyoto Protocol survive because they don't feel that they have any supplemental commitment. They don't see that they're historically responsible and therefore they should have extra emissions reduction targets, whereas the developing world should just be able to do low carbon growth and some basic stuff. And so they wanted to kill the Kyoto Protocol and have this one treaty for everyone. And so they took 3 days, and the G77 and a lot of small island states fought them hard. And so now we've wasted a lot of time, but we've come down to the fact that negotiations are continuing in both tracks. And so right now, a potential outcome is an amendment to the Kyoto Protocol with a new set of targets for all countries that are relevant to that, that are signatories to that, and a supplemental treaty on finance and forests and adaptation and all that other extra cool stuff that came out in Bali. There's still potential for the Kyoto Protocol to be killed if developed countries won't sign on to it. So then another option is one legally binding treaty that has kind of everything and could impose emissions reduction targets on the developing world. There could also be a political statement that comes out, which is basically could be considered a greenwash or could be kind of a schedule for how they're going to go about doing this in the next 2 years or 3 years before 2013. And that would be something like what the G8 said, whereas like we support 2 degrees, but no information on how we're going to do that. The negotiations could collapse. They could come out with nothing. The likelihood right now is a greenwash, is either a political statement or a decision from the COP that basically doesn't say very much, that doesn't have any specific targets or any overarching target for the global carbon budget, that doesn't have any schedule for adaptation financing, that doesn't commit developed countries to legally binding technological or financial transfers to the global south, that basically is just a political statement that we kind of support this thing and we'll kind of do something about it later.
So if we end up with an agreement like that, what are the next steps moving forward? Is that just the end of things or do we have to wait till next year?
I think for us, the focus right now is less on the outcome and where we are as much as just building the movement. I really do think that. I'm a policy nerd and I'm thinking about becoming an organizer. I think that these negotiators come here with predetermined platforms upon which they will and will not negotiate, and that needs to stop. And that needs to mean that the entire world is calling for a fair, ambitious, and legally binding treaty. And whether or not that's 2 things or 3 things or 1 thing or 5 things, it doesn't really matter anymore. What matters is that everyone everyone is holding their leaders accountable, so that they can't compromise the planet, and they can't compromise the survival of developing nations. And so I would argue that none of this wonkiness really matters right now, that it just matters that we scream until they listen.
Although negotiations were scheduled to finish today, it looks like they may extend into the weekend, or at least late into the night. We'll deliver a final review of what was achieved here in Copenhagen once this round of negotiations are over. For now, we'll leave you with a few thoughts from Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
For those who think that the rich are going to escape.
This has been a podcast from the Canadian Youth Delegation to Copenhagen for the UN climate change negotiations. Hear more on iTunes or at cydcopenhagen.org.
It's now time for a quick PSA break. Stay tuned. Weather's up next.
MentalBeast.com is set to release its new comedy series,
telling the riotously funny Christmas tale of a radio station on the verge of collapse.
Starting December 7th, visit MentalBeast.com to follow the podcasts and video episodes.
Each podcast will feature a brand new Christmas-themed song by one of Vancouver's hottest indie acts, while the webisodes follow the behind-the-scenes antics at this down-on-its-luck station.
The series culminates with a party at the Biltmore Friday, December 18th, and the release of the Eggnog Experience compilation CD.
Featuring holiday performances from compilation contributors Brastronaut, Machu Picchu, Fine Mist, Makeup Videotape, World Club, Needles and Pins, Analog Bell Service, Rose Melberg and Nick Hergovich, Basketball, Tight, Solid, Vancouver, and Apollo Ghosts.
And a live special screening of the final video episode of Mental Beast.
As well as CITR's own Radio Zero DJs Tyler Fedchuk and Cam Dales. So join CITR and Mental Beast at the Biltmore on December 18th.
All the proceeds from the Mental Beast Project and Eggnog Experience compilation album will be donated to the Vancouver Food Bank.
Morning.
Good day to you, sir. Hey, wait a minute, what the hell? Getting real tired of you ducking me, man. Yeah?
Oh, my God.
Thank you to all the donors who pledged their financial support during the CITR on-air fund drive. We are moved by your generosity, and thank you for enabling us to purchase some new equipment and improve our programming. Do remember to stop by the station, pay your pledges, and pick up your prizes. We look forward to meeting you anytime between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. on weekdays. Thank you again for your amazing response. Listen to our happy voices on the air, happier after we purchase new equipment for our studios. Thanks again.
Oh, my God! All right, let's go to the bank.
Welcome back. Unfortunately, we do not have your weekend weather forecast for you, so that's our program for December 18th, 2009. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Andrew Longhurst produces radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 for the next edition of News 101. I'm Carrie Baptist. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Hot Mess on CITR 101.9 FM.